wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this November 9th Monday. I want to give a big thank you to our dedicated KBOO staff who over these last 7 months have kept the amazing radio produced for our community on the air. This morning on the Old Mole post-election, Bill Resnick interviews John Cavana, director of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. They discuss what a Biden administration might do on the great issues of our day, if indeed mightily pushed by the left. That includes, of course, climate change, pandemics, racism, militarism, and poverty, among many others. Desiree Helliger speaks with Ray Austin, an organizer with Portland's Black Lives Matter movement, and Diane Meisenhelter of the Defend Democracy Coalition. They'll talk about the ongoing organizing to defend democracy as the vote count for the presidential election continues. As we know now, this morning, Joe Biden was confirmed as president on Saturday, November 7th. In the second half of our program, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, in their Left in the Law segment, survey some of the victories in the November elections for criminal justice reform. They also discuss the criminal case against human rights attorney Stephen Donziger, ultimately for holding Chevron responsible for its heinous oil mining practices in the Amazonian Ecuador. Jan and Mike take up what's at stake for oil companies in pursuing charges against Donziger, who is represented by criminal defense attorney Lauren Regan, senior attorney with the Civil Liberties Defense Center. And Desiree Helliger returns to talk with Sarah Chivers and Samantha Edgerton, organizers with the New Pacific Northwest Intercampus Organizing Collective, and with Lakota Cheyenne activist Robin White, an old mole as well. They'll talk about the upcoming November 13th virtual Pacific Northwest-wide organizing summit, Organizing to Confront Academic Disaster Capitalism in the Age of Pandemics. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members old and new for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm, Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and John Cavana.
John Cavana, welcome to KBOO.
Pleasure to be with you.
John Cavana is the director of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. He's written quite a few books. His most recent articles include Trump trade wars have led to losing U.S. jobs and factories. We need a worker-centered recovery. He also wrote How to Raise $9 trillion for Working-Class People Without Really Trying. The Institute for Policy Studies itself examines the country and the world, discussing the big challenges and the means of meeting them. The big challenges, of course, include the degradation of ecosystems and global warming, growing authoritarianism, imperialism, militarism, poverty and inequality. It's a long list. Racism and misogyny is also, of course, public health and increasing pandemics. As to the latter, this COVID could well be mild compared to a highly contagious and highly lethal virus that could well come. Of course, all of those crises and the troubles are interconnected, and the list goes on. But the Institute is not a doom and gloom operation. They do point out, like so many others who use their research and studies, that the planet is fast moving towards catastrophes. They also demonstrate that we know what must be done, and they discuss how to deploy all our ample resources to create democratic, sustainable societies. And they see this country as crucial to share leadership and resources with the rest of the world. So, John Cavana, we're recording this Friday. It'll be last Friday for our listeners. The day that Biden pulled ahead in Georgia and Pennsylvania and appears to have beaten Trump, though no one knows what our esteemed president and his Justice Department and his Second Amendment people might do in his last 2.5 months in office. All that said, John Cavanna, let's say you were selected to be part of the Biden Brain Trust and were writing his inaugural address. What would you put in it?
That's an interesting way to put it, because he is listening to progressives just as he's listening to centrists and conservatives. Here's what I would say. First, the next 2 months before his inauguration are critical to what goes into that speech. So let me just say two things about progressives and what we should be focused on in November and December. The first is we still desperately need an emergency COVID relief package. And there is, I think, a better than 50-50 chance when we can get one passed in December. Republicans are feeling the pressure to do it. Their cities and states are broke, and people are really hurting. So one, progressives need to focus on that in November and December. Heavy pressure, not just on Biden and Harris to talk about it, but on progressives in Congress and in the Senate to pass it. I think there's a good shot we could get what we desperately need, which is another $1,200 check for everybody. Unemployment insurance, vitally important. It's been gone for millions of workers since August. And aid to cities and states, many of whom are laying off vital workers because they don't have the money. So keep pressure on that. If you get that passed, it'll change a little bit what you would say in your inauguration. And the second thing is something which the whole country is now focused on, which is that a Biden presidency can do much more, and progressives can do much more in pushing a Biden presidency if they get the Senate. And right now, as of the moment you're listening to this, Republicans have 50 senators in the next Senate, and Democrats have 48. And the final two seats will be decided on January 5th in two runoff elections in the state of Georgia. The state where the election was or is the closest, it will be decided by a couple thousand votes either way, and there will be a recount. So, huge amount of emphasis is going to go into Georgia. I would encourage people to support that. There are great groups there like Black Voters Matter, like the Poor People's Campaign is working hard in Georgia. They all need help, because if those two senators become Democrats, then the Senate's 50-50. It then Mitch McConnell, the soon-to-be most hated man in America, as Donald Trump recedes, will be out of power if it's 50-50. If the Democrats control the White House, which they do, they get to determine things in the Senate, and big things can happen in the Senate. So we will know that at the time of your questions about the inaugural address, but those two things are critical for every progressive in the next 2 months. Now, going to 2021 and what Biden should lay out and what progressives can win. Keep in mind, most of the damage that Trump did, he didn't have the House of Representatives. That was Democrat controlled. So 90% of the horrors that he visited on this country were through executive action. He pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Accords. He pulled the U.S. out of the World Health Organization. He deregulated corporate America and allowed them to pollute and to abuse workers and so on. Joe Biden, through executive actions, can do a great deal. And IPS has been working a lot with the Congressional Progressive Caucus and the Congressional Progressive Caucus Center. We have 8 memos in different areas that lay out what Joe Biden could be pressed to do through executive orders and other forms of executive action to undo the Trump horrors. So that's one category. It's very important, and it's something to be excited about, even if McConnell retains control of the Senate. I've mentioned some of the things that they would undo, but a huge one will be this. The pandemic continues to be one of the central crises in 2021, along with the economic crisis, along with the racial justice crisis, along with the climate crisis. But the pandemic is global. It can only be resolved globally. So through executive action, the administration could not only rejoin the World Health Organization, it could become a leader in a global effort to have completely free vaccines for all in every country. Right now, under the Trump model, corporate America would determine how much vaccines cost, who gets them. It's a horror show right now. So there's a great deal he can do through executive action. But the other thing, just to say for progressives, I'd keep your eye on a couple other things. One, what we've learned over the past couple of years is there's some things that we can win because all we'll need is two Republican senators to win them. There's things we can win legislatively. I'll give you an example. One, progressives have made a big priority of saving the post office. It is vital that we not just save the post office, but expand it. One way to really go after racial injustice in this country is to have postal banking. But for that, the post office needs money. At least three Republican senators have come out for giving more money to the post office. So we could win that. I'll give you another one. You will recall, many of the listeners, that Bernie Sanders led an effort over the past 2 years to successfully pass resolutions in this Republican-controlled Senate, and then Ilhan Omar and Mark Pocan did this in the House, that would cut off U.S. military sales to Saudi Arabia and stop U.S. involvement in the war in Yemen, which is killing hundreds of thousands of people. Bernie Sanders found 7 isolationist Republicans who'd vote for that, and then Trump vetoed it. So we can pass things like that. I'll give you another example, and this is where we get into progressive sort of expanding their sense of the possible. It turns out most Americans, including many who voted for Trump, are appalled that billionaires made up to $1 trillion off the pandemic. We at IPS call them pandemic profiteers, but this is Jeff Bezos and the CEOs of Zoom and the CEOs of Google and so on. They've made money off the pandemic. Most Americans think that that is outrageous and immoral. So I could imagine a pandemic billionaire tax actually passing, which taxes that ill-gotten wealth of billionaires during the pandemic and makes that money available for the things we need to transition our economy to a green economy, to help workers, and so on.
Right. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland. I'm talking to John Cavanna of the Institute for Policy Studies. The Institute analyzes, thinks, proposes. They know what must be done on a planet now living in a period of mounting, serious to say the least, crises. We're discussing this on the day Biden victory seems assured. We're discussing what a Biden administration could do despite the Senate, who will oppose near anything he proposes. John Cavanna, I think it is clear that they're going to have to pass a COVID relief bill. And also it will include, I hope, Trump's infrastructure bill that was never proposed or acted on, actually. He was just promising it constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
It could be an infrastructure and energy modernization act to create jobs, good jobs, sort of a Green New Deal, basically. Maybe not use that term because the right is so savaged.
It
solves the poverty and insecurity and job problem. It would go a long way in the U.S. to actually moving towards real action on global warming, depending on how large the appropriation is and who gets the money to create those jobs. It seems to me that we have a tremendous opportunity now to restructure energy production and the way it's organized, and to displace the investor-owned utilities with democratic, locally confederated energy agencies, as many California cities have already done. There are places around the world where local energy is now supplying a great percentage of their power. And we wouldn't need a huge trillion-dollar big grid, which, of course, will burn up or be blown down or flooded out frequently. John Cavanna, tell us about those possibilities.
Sure. Well, I ask you all listening to this to think back just 1 year. Pre-pandemic, pre-economic crisis, there were 2 giant issues in the U.S. and the world. One was a global climate movement led by youth, and one was a real upsurge in understanding and outrage over racial injustice in this country and around the world. But the movement that had millions of young people on the streets was the climate youth movement. And what you got out of that, which was fascinating, was a debate in almost every country in the world about the fact that if the climate crisis at that point was the number one crisis in the world, every country would have to go through a massive transformation of their economies into a clean energy economy. And if they did it right, they could create millions of good jobs. In this case, good union jobs in the United States, of course, is what we wanted. That debate returns in 2021. When we no longer have Trump, the world will return to that and the pandemic, and of course they're interrelated, but as the number one issue. So in the United States, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris understand it. And I'll say it was really interesting to watch climate movements in the U.S. go after Biden on this. They pushed hard. In the summer, there was a Biden-Sanders task force on climate that included AOC, it included the head of the Sunrise Movement, and they got Biden to move to the left on climate.
Yeah, I want to agree with you. In fact, I read his second climate action plan. It was quite radical. I was just shocked by it because it adopted a lot of the language of those who would want to build a democratic system.
Right. What I think Biden recognized, and which just happened in this election, he recognized he could only win if he inspired a number of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren supporters. And it was a brilliant move by Sanders to push this. He took those task forces very seriously. And that one was combative, and it was interesting, and Biden moved to the left. Now, the challenge of progressives in 2021 is to hold him to that and press him on that. And you are right that a key space where we can do that is in the next COVID relief bill, which will either be in December or, if that gets mucked up, it'll be the first act of business of the new Biden administration. And I do think that you're right. I want to just flash people back for 1 second, 12 years ago. Barack Obama is elected. It's in the midst of a terrible recession and economic crisis. Progressives said to him, you got to do a massive stimulus bill and it has to be green. And so he did, but it wasn't carefully laid out what that would look like. And most of the money, you know, the overwhelming majority went to repairing highways and things like that. I think everybody is much smarter 12 years later. There are a lot of very good proposals for transforming the economy. So I think there's a great chance to get money in for transforming our energy and manufacturing infrastructure in a way that's much greener. I think the harder part is where you ended, Bill, which is, can you do this in a way that is democratically controlled? Because big corporations are sitting there ready to jump in. We do work in New Mexico. A big new multi-billion dollar deal has just been announced for clean energy in New Mexico, but by a giant company, a global corporation. So progressives have both got to push for that transformation, and we've got a shot of getting money to go in this direction under Biden. And then the fight of our lives will be, can we do this in a way that is democratically controlled? You're right, we've got some models from California and other states, and a lot of this fight will happen at a local and state level. And everybody should keep that in mind. We're going to have Biden and Harris as our president and vice president, but a lot of what we can win in the next 2 to 4 years is similar to what we won in the last 4 years, which is at a local and state level. So the fight for energy co-ops that are democratically controlled will happen, a lot of it in your own town and in your own state, and progressives have to remember that. We've got to fight on each of these levels. We've got to be internationalists and get back into global agreements that can help people around the world and help the planet. We've got to be fighting at this national level with a divided Senate and House. And then we've got to be fighting at the state and local level. And I think most people are capable of thinking at those three levels. We are simultaneously global citizens, national citizens, and local citizens.
John Cavanna, that's a good way to end. It was great talking to you. A few last words. My sense is that people are ready, and it's vitally necessary, for what could be a huge crusade that brought not just progressives together, not just most of the Democratic Party, but would reach out to working people across the country, many of whom may have voted for Trump, but could be switched to a very progressive kind of reconstruction What we need is a sort of a crusade to reconstruct our economy and our planet and to live much better and together democratically. Just my sense is, maybe I'm being over-optimistic, it's not bad, especially right before going to sleep, if you can.
Right.
I think that crusade somehow could occur, and people could learn a whole lot for it. And one thing about the Black Lives Matter marches and even this election that brought in so many, many more people into politics, maybe not terribly intelligently, but they got involved in some way. I think you can build on that sort of enthusiasm and those precedents to build a crusade.
Sure. Quick reminder, big change in this country happens when there's powerful social movements. There are powerful social movements in this country, many that cut across issue. And I would highlight the Poor People's Campaign, hitting poverty, racism, militarism, environment, and the Movement for Black Lives. Both of them fusion movements that bring in unions, environmentalists, racial justice groups, and so on. Those groups have momentum. And to win the things we've just talked about, we are going to need that kind of massive coordinated movement action. I think it can happen. I also point you all to the Congressional Progressive Caucus. There's going to be a summit on November 13th and 12th and 13th that anyone can join for free. Just go to the Congressional Progressive Caucus Center website and you can join that. You'll meet great new people who've been elected, like Jamal Bowman and Richie Torres. You'll see Ilhan Omar and Deb Haaland and others. It is movements pushing good progressive leaders at the local, state, and national level that will bring the kind of change that we've just discussed in the, over these minutes.
John Cabana, thanks so much for talking to us today.
My pleasure.
You can find John Cabana's, a lot of his articles and the titles of his book by going to the IPS, Institute for Policy Studies website. Good talking to you, John. Thanks.
Great talking to you. Good luck in this next stage.
Right. So long.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM and listener-supported community radio. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning. Later in our program, Desiree Hellegers will talk with Sarah Chivers, Samantha Edgerton, and Lakota Cheyenne activist Robin White. They'll be talking about campus organizing and academics and organizing to confront academic disaster capitalism in the age of pandemics. We will also hear from Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking about criminal justice reforms, victories during our recent elections, and the ongoing criminal case against human rights attorney Stephen Donziger. But next on The Old Mole, we have Desiree Hellegers talking with Ray Austin and Diane Meisenhelter about the Defend Democracy Coalition and how folks can get involved with ongoing pressure to maintain democracy in Portland and the United States. Desiree?
I'm speaking today with Diane Meisenhelter with the Defend Democracy Coalition and also with Ray Austin, who is an organizer, leader of the Black Lives Matter movement in Portland and also band leader of the Frontline Drumline. What do you most need us to know right now? And do you want to start us off?
Sure. Voters decided for Biden with record voter engagement and turnout. In a democracy, voters choose their leaders. Leaders don't get to pick and choose which votes should be counted. And with voter suppression and lies and threats of court battles, the Trump administration is still trying to steal this election, despite what voters decided. The Defend Democracy Coalition of over 50 local organizations, racial and social justice, immigrant rights, labor, faith communities, environmental, women's and LGBTQ groups is doing all within our power to protect the election results. And we're also fighting for what people truly need: racial justice, health care, family wage jobs and protections, action to stem the pandemic, climate justice, and so much more. So we say electoral justice is racial justice, but that's a hollow promise if the next administration doesn't deliver in the needs of frontline communities, Black, Brown, Indigenous communities, workers and essential workers, the homeless, the elderly, children and families. This too is the work of the Defend Democracy Coalition. And you can follow our calls to action on social media. We must stand strong, both in protecting the results and making those results meaningful.
Now, Ray, so do you want to tell us a little bit about where you think things stand and what we need to know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, just as Diane said, this is such a critical time, right? You know, Donald Trump has proven that he's not interested in respecting the democratic process. For several months now, he's been laying the groundwork, you know, to stage an undermining of that process. You know, he's undermined the integrity of mail-in voting, right? He has, you know, worked to dismantle the U.S. Post Office, and he has mobilized his Proud Boys and, you know, his white supremacist forces to engage in voter suppression, right? So, I mean, he's made it very clear that he's going to use any means necessary to stage a political coup. And so it's imperative that we, as people, as everyday citizens, as organizers, stage our resistance to that oppression, right? Because, you know, quite unfortunately, it's become clear that, you know, the Democrats, a lot of elected officials in office, aren't willing to resist him in any meaningful way. And so I think that really falls upon the people to do that work ourselves, right? And that means organizing, that means taking to the streets, that means engaging in the legislative process and putting pressure on elected officials to do so on our behalf. Because as of right now, you know, Trump, he's already in the White House, he's already seized that control, and he's not interested in letting it go. So we need to let him know that that will not be tolerated.
And are there actions locally that you want people to respond to?
We had three actions this last week, and we're going to be organizing more, focusing on the pillars of power, the media, financial institutions, corporations. Our website is defenddemocracycoalition.com.
We're taping on Friday. You've got a lot of events going on this weekend. You've had events on Wednesday, but you're going to be regrouping this for a little while. And then folks need to just stay tuned to that website and look for updates on future actions. We are not out of the woods yet, is your message. And we really need to stay tuned and stay aware and be ready to defend democracy.
You know, I think it's so imperative that people right now who are concerned, as you know, as we all should be, you know, really take it upon themselves to engage with and get involved in communities of resistance, right? There's a really powerful movement here in Portland with the Black Lives Matter movement and a lot of tangential movements as well. Yeah, I think that my call to action would be take action yourself to do some research, find ways to get plugged in locally to organizing and to resistance spaces so that you can figure out what your role is going forward. And then just continue to do that, because I think it's going to fall on all of us to be that revolution ourselves.
I've been talking with Diane Meisenhelter and Ray Austin. Thank you both so much for joining me today.
This has been Desiree Helligers for the Olmo Variety Hour.
I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Community Radio. That was Desiree Helligers. She'll return later in our program to talk with Sarah Chivers, Samantha Edgerton, and Robin White. Sarah and Robin are both Old Moles. They'll be talking about organizing to confront academic disaster capitalism in the age of pandemics. Next, we turn to The Left and the Law with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, and they are going to survey some of the victories in the November elections around criminal justice reform. And they will also discuss the criminal case against human rights attorney Stephen Donziger.
Good morning. Mike will be discussing the upcoming trial of human rights attorney Stephen Donziger this morning. But first, let's touch on a few of the Left and the Law highlights in this grueling election season. We know that Trump lost, which is cause for celebration, but there are important local measures that passed that are pretty significant victories. Portlanders voted overwhelmingly for a new community police oversight system, and the majority of Oregonians voted for decriminalizing drug possession. So Mike, how would you assess these two successful measures as part of the larger movement for racial justice and criminal justice reform?
I think they're extraordinary, Jan, this is particularly the decriminalizing of small amounts of drugs, because that is the greatest effort toward racial justice that happened in this season or in a long time, because it's a striking huge number of police encounters with black and brown people involve small amounts of drugs. It's also used as an excuse for a lot of encounters that swell up into assault charges and multiply into all sorts of ugly facets. So that in and of itself will lessen the need for police too. The effects of that are already starting to reverberate around the country, and it's a demonstration of how far ahead the people are, ahead of politicians who grew up in an era when being tough on crime was maybe the only ticket to higher office. The idea that people don't want that is vividly expressed by these initiatives, but has yet to be really fully recognized by politicians.
With Measure 2617, the Police Oversight Commission, you know, there's a long history of various oversight or advisory community committees that have in many ways served to further put a veil over the depths of the problem. Is this any different from previous oversight or community advisory commissions or committees?
Well, it certainly has stronger language. It allows cops to be fired. It has a much greater reach. It gives more power in terms of investigation of just what happened in any single incident. It's much, much stronger. Having said all that, we'll see. It's a matter of practice. It's really strong. It's well-drafted. It's supported by 80% of the people. But the cops are resourceful, and they've been accustomed to winning. It's been impossible to ever discipline anybody, ever fire anybody. This should make it happen, but we just need to watch it carefully. And the first couple or three times it is used will be pivotal in determining how effective it is in the long run.
In earlier segments on our Left in the Law, we've taken up the progressive prosecutors movement in cities around the country, and some of those were in primaries. Did the left win anything with the law this week on that front?
Well, we won phenomenally. I mean, the most stunning development was what happened in Los Angeles. Los Angeles has the biggest prosecutor's office in the whole wide world. They've got 1,100 deputy district attorneys. They have put 229 people on death row in Los Angeles, three quarters of them black or brown. And they just elected maybe the most progressive prosecutor in the whole country. He said he will not seek the death penalty. He will reevaluate every single death case. And if there are meritorious petitions for habeas corpus, he will settle them. He will work to get rid of the death penalty altogether. He's going to not charge people youths as adults. He's as progressive as Chesa Boudin in San Francisco, but he's got a grand jurisdiction. He's got millions of people that he's in charge of. With his leadership, this is the most significant single development. The pioneer was Larry Krasner in Philadelphia. These are prosecutors who aren't just being nice and liberal. Krasner fired seven of his most militant deputy DAs who were always charging excessively with anybody from neighborhoods in Philadelphia they didn't like, or skin colors or cultures they didn't like. He just fired them. And Gascon may well do the same thing.
So these are signs of the successes of the Black Lives Matter movement, the movement for major criminal justice reform. And I think often these victories get overlooked in some of the discouraging areas of the picture around police budgets that still remain bloated.
It's the most dramatic example of the power and impact of the Black Lives Matter demonstrations and what happened in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. Because in the primary time, Jackie Lacey, a Black female prosecutor, was very close to winning an absolute majority. She had 49%, but she had never, ever prosecuted any policeman for killing some of the several hundred people who have been killed over the past decade by Los Angeles cops. She's been completely a tool, is not too strong, really, when it comes to the way she scrutinized or did not scrutinize the policeman. Now, in the primary, she won 49%. George Gascon won like 23%. And this other deputy DA, Rachel Rossi, won about 20%. But Jackie Lacey stomped them both, came within a hair of getting a majority. Then George Floyd happened. All the demonstrations happened. Huge demonstrations, often in Los Angeles, all around the country. And when the election time came, the top two vote-getters in the primary, Jackie Lacey and George Gascon, went head-to-head. Gascon just trounced her, won by 10 to 12 percentage points, even though she had had twice the votes he had before. So that's really a quantitative demonstration of the power of all the Black Lives Matter demonstrations.
Yeah, and I think those victories, there's still a long, hard road ahead, but it is important to acknowledge these successes of the movement. Well, let's talk about the trial of human rights attorney Stephen Donziger that was scheduled to begin next week. It's been delayed till January. It's an ongoing, quite tragic and horrendous story of someone who's been a champion of human rights and fought Chevron on the behalf of Amazonian Ecuador and communities there. Tell us about that case from a legal standpoint. First, can you summarize the charges against him that seem quite bizarre, and then where he is in terms of the scheduled trial in Lower Manhattan this week that's been delayed?
Well, you know, corporate power is something that is usually masked. It is subtle and soft by use of influencers and subtle contributions and sometimes large financial contributions. But in this case, it's naked power, huge, even decisive worldwide issues are at stake. And Chevron believes, and I think they're right, that they're fighting literally for their life. Because what happened was Chevron bought Texaco. Texaco had been exploring for oil in the Amazon and had left behind them a toxic mess that filtered throughout huge areas of hitherto untouched rainforest and poisoned wells, damaged communities over a very wide area. Chevron was sued initially in New York, but they wanted to move it to Ecuador. They said the Ecuador system was fair, and they basically wanted to dodge a jury trial because there were no juries for these particular issues in Ecuador. Yeah, this is in the early 90s. And Ecuador ultimately dinged them for $18 billion, which is reduced on appeal to $9 billion. And it was not a number randomly picked. They went over the tremendous amount of acreage, the damage, and the cost of repairing the damages that had been done. Chevron promptly abandoned the entire country. They did not want to have any assets there that could be seized. And they attacked Donziger in every possible way. They disbarred him. He's now a prisoner in his own house with ankle bracelets on. He's being charged with criminal contempt by a judge who is a complete worshiper of Chevron, who said that they provide us with liquids and lubricants that everyone uses every day. He has tried to demonize Donziger. He's now being tried for criminal contempt. They've never tried him with anything that would give him a jury trial. He's now being accused of being mean in court, and so they made that into a criminal contempt case.
Because he would not hand over his laptop.
Well, they want his cell phone, too. They want his cell phone and laptop under the guise of getting, they want the addresses of everyone he ever interviewed for any purpose, or that any of his assistants interviewed in Ecuador. It's a complete full court press. It's chased away a couple of really great law firms who freely said, we can't deal with this.
There are hundreds of hours. I mean, the legal team on behalf of Chevron is pretty staggering. So clearly they see a lot is at stake here, and they've spent apparently staggering sums to bring down Donziger. And so it's this very, very big Goliath against David here. What's at stake? On the face of it, it just seems so horrific that they would spend so much money to bring this guy down, who has an international reputation that's pretty sterling and has mounted a defense with the help of a lot of pro bono lawyers around the world, as well as Lauren Regan here in Eugene, who's been on the Left and the Law, who's his attorney now in this trial that's been delayed till January. What do you think the aim is for Chevron and the courts?
Well, only 20 companies are responsible for a third of the greenhouse gases emitted in the modern era. Chevron is number two, right behind Saudi Arabia's Aramco. What's at stake is the cost of doing business, externalities. Now, these companies are used to having communities pick up the check and the tab and the pain of the work that they do in order to extract oil. What's happened in Ecuador is that they were held responsible for those externalities or additional costs as a result of their work. You might have noticed that alternate energy forms are gaining rapidly in every way. They're getting cheaper with time goes by. They're getting, the methods of distribution are improving. They are being threatened, they being Chevron, by the rise of alternate forms of energy. If they are made responsible for the impact of their work, that's going to just shred their competitiveness in all sorts of different ways. They view this as dire threat to the whole way of doing business that has created them in the first place. They've hired no less than like 60 law firms to take on Doniger and a handful of other people over the past 20 years. They see it as literally a matter of life or death. And that's why they're fighting the way they are.
Yeah, so we will continue to follow this case, and we're very proud of Lauren Regan and the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene for their work and joining this case of defending him. So there's some bright spots in the sky after the election, but there are a lot of big black holes out there.
There are indeed.
Yeah.
Smelly ones. Dirty
yeah.
Ones.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Mike. This is Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker with our post-election review and discussion of the incredible case and heroic work of attorney Stephen Donziger.
Time and an aggressive time, a painful time, a time where cynicism rots the vine, and a time where violence blocks the summer shine. Lifetimes go by in a flash, in a search for love, in a search for cash. Everybody wanna be some fat tycoon, everybody wanna be on a tropic honeymoon. Nobody wanna sing a little bit out of tune, or be the backbone of a rebel platoon. It's too soon to step out of line. You might get laughed at, you might get fined, but do you fear me when I say I feel pain every day when I see the way my friends gotta slay and never get ahead of bills they gotta pay? No way, no way. Some make a living doing killing, Colombian penicillin. Some are willing to play the villain, they just chilling to pass the time, pass the information, or pass the wine, pass the buck, or pass the baton. But you can't pass the police or in the Pentagon, the IRS or the upper echelon. I think it's time to make a move on the contradiction. Bomb, bomb.
the nation. Take over television and radio station. Bam, bam. The truth shall come. Give the corporations a complication. Bam, bam. Rock the nation. Take over television and radio station. Bam, bam. The truth shall come.
To conclude our program this morning, Desiree Helliger talks with Sarah Chivers, an old mole, and Samantha Edgerton. They're both organizers with the New Pacific Northwest Intercampus Organizing Collective. She'll also talk in this segment with Lakota Cheyenne activist Robin White, who is an old mole as well. And they'll talk about the upcoming November 13th virtual Pacific Northwest-wide organizing summit, organizing to confront academic capitalism in the age of pandemics.
I'm talking today with Sarah Chivers, who's an adjunct professor at Portland State University and Chemeketa Community College, and also with Samantha Edgerton, who is a second-year PhD student studying modern U.S. history at Washington State University. Samantha is vice president of the Graduate and Professional Student Association, the GPSA, the representative body for graduate and professional students at WSU, and the three of us have been helping to organize the upcoming organizing summit for academic workers, for higher ed workers, for students throughout the Pacific Northwest called Organizing to Confront Academic Disaster Capitalism in the Age of Pandemics. Sam Edgerton actually has COVID right now, so we are amazed that we're actually able to speak to her. So do you want to talk a little bit about this upcoming summit? Basically, it's a free online interactive organizing summit to begin building power across the Pacific Northwest to radically re-envision higher education as equitable, sustainable, affordable, and accessible to all. Sarah, do you want to start in? Why do you think this event is important?
I've been teaching for about 15 years, and things have gotten progressively worse, and it's time for things to start getting better. One of the biggest issues that we're dealing with now is the way that community colleges and universities in our region are run like businesses. Students are suffering the most. Undergraduate students and graduate students are bearing the burden of these costs of higher education. At the same time, they're suffering from housing and food insecurity. It's really time for us to re-envision a future of higher education for the public based on education being a common good. We're really working to bring people together, to build collective power, to pressure legislators, to cap administrative salaries. For example, at Portland State University, there are administrators who make what an adjunct professor would make in a year, administrators make in a month.
And Sam, you're actually going to be speaking on the conditions, particularly confronting graduate students.
Graduate students have been preoccupied with the shift to digital teaching and learning. They've also been experiencing exhaustion and stress, particularly for students from marginalized communities as they face additional burdens. They're the ones who are contending with eviction, hunger, and the impact of COVID-19 itself. With lots of potential budget cuts on the horizon, there's a real possibility, too, for labor exploitation. And then from my own experience with COVID itself, which also adds to the physical experience of the pandemic, as well as more mental stress. This places a tremendous burden on low-income, working-class, and first-generation graduate students. In areas where universities chose to open up this fall for person-to-person instruction, graduate students need transparency and plans for testing and protecting their physical safety. In addition, labs have closed, jeopardizing deadlines and financial aid, escalating fees, stipends that are too low to cover the cost of living in university communities, and the abysmal state of the academic job market are now magnified by the pandemic. Graduate students are, especially marginalized communities, are holding dual roles. So you've got graduate parents who don't have childcare, as well as job opportunities in local university communities as well, have essentially faded away due to the economic repercussions of the pandemic.
Okay. And so even though we have eviction moratoriums right now, a lot of them are facing a really uncertain future in terms of both housing and food security.
The Great Recession of 2008, combined with this recent COVID pandemic, have essentially doubled student debt since 2008. We expect to continue to see student debt increase, and no one at the state or federal level is addressing these types of issues.
Another issue that we're addressing at our organizing summit has to do with public safety and community safety. One of our speakers on our panel will be Red Hamilton, who is an organizer with Disarm PSU and is on the board of OPAL here in Portland and has been showing real leadership in disarming campus safety officers and building community support and mutual aid. Another really important theme that we'll be covering at the summit is about decolonizing higher education, centering the voices and experiences of Black, Indigenous, Latino students and educators. In the communities where I teach, Board of Trustees are voting to cut most of the programming that supports BIPOC communities. So for example, the Oregon Promise was really decimated this year by our Oregon legislators. And the Oregon Promise is a really key piece of funding that community college students use in order to obtain an education. And I think finally, one of the issues that I'm most passionate about is labor and adjunctification and the exploitation of higher education workers. We are called to teach in emergency situations with little prep time, without much support in terms of professional development or training, and yet we're the first on the chopping block when there's a budget crisis. So what we really want to do is stop the bleeding, address the ultimate causes that are creating this vicious treadmill that's burdening students with decades worth of debt, leaving many of us educators living in impoverished conditions, all the while propping up administrators who are making decisions that are continuing this vicious cycle.
Okay, yeah, and just to note too that almost every AAUP in the Pacific Northwest has thrown their support behind this organizing efforts. It's the first time that we know of anyway that academic workers and students from across the region will gather together to look at how can we mount coordinated campaigns across campuses, across community colleges and universities for unified fight for justice and for education that's genuinely equitable, sustainable, affordable, and accessible to all. So that again, that's coming up on November 13th from 4 to 7 p.m. All right. Well, thank you so much, Sam and Sarah, for speaking with me today. And I'm going to talk here in a minute with Robin White, who is going to be facilitating one of the sessions. And just to do a shout out as well for the fact that PSU's Jose Padin, who's the immediate past president of the PSU, American Association of University Professors, AAUP, is going to be one of the speakers at the event. You can find out more about this event by going to www.peacock.info, and we will post the information when we post this segment. So I'm talking also this morning with Robin White, who is actually a member of the Old Mole Variety Hour Radio Collective, but also a member of the WSU Vancouver Native American Community Advisory Board. And Robin, you're going to be facilitating this session on fossil fuel divestment and reinvestment.
You know, I think it's important that we realize how fast the climate collapse is approaching us and that we don't have the time we thought we had. I think the only way to really address that is to go directly to where the money is. You know, you got to follow the money. If in Washington and Oregon or in the Northwest, we've got incredible amount of pension monies in of unions. We have universities that are investing this money.
WSU does not yet have a fossil fuel divestment campaign, and we aim to change that situation in the next week. But I mean, you know, there are a number of other institutions around the Pacific Northwest that have gotten some traction on these issues. What can we be learning from each other's kind of campaign strategies and tactics? WSU is holding the single largest portfolio of indigenous lands of any land grant university in the U.S., right? And so where is that money ironically being invested? It's being invested in fossil fuel infrastructure that is driving climate change and probably the worst casualties of climate change in Washington State in particular are indigenous communities that are frontline communities like the Quinault, right?
Tribes in particular have an extraordinarily hard time getting loans or getting money, and as do individual Native businesses and so on and so forth. These people are the most affected by fossil fuels and the toxicities of them. Yet economically, they really struggle to grow and to do the right thing. It's funny that, you know, basically we're relying on them to do the right thing for salmon recovery, for environmental recovery and of stewardship, but we're not helping finance them. In Washington, the tribal economy is, I think, the fourth largest employer, but we need to, you know, do the right thing in that type of infrastructure as well and support them with some of these investment and reinvestment programs so that they can do the job that we really are asking them to do now. And we need to do better by
them. Yeah, I just want to be clear too that there's a whole session on decolonization at the organizing summit, and that's going to be facilitated by University of Washington professor Jean Dennison, who is also, she's the co-director for the Center for American Indian and Indigenous Studies and an associate professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Washington. And so, you know, that's going to be another session that's going to be running at the same time. And it looks like a lot of people have signed up for that session. So, you know, there's a robust land back movement right now. If land grant universities are still accruing funds from indigenous lands that we're holding, first step, right, is to move those investments out of fossil fuels and into tribal communities.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like a slap in the face, really, to these people that continue to do that. And I think it's extraordinarily irresponsible. Honestly, I think it's irresponsible economically, but it's also just morally. Kind of
reprehensible. Yeah, and I mean, we're seeing Exxon's stocks, right? Exxon's profits basically tanking, right? So the question is the Biden administration going to continue to bail them out?
I think it's important to understand that. And, you know, I've been trying to tell particularly people in labor that we're not doing our fiduciary responsibility when we don't divest out of fossil fuels and a lot of these things that are we know are going to collapse and that we know they're just trying to get the last bits of money out of. I mean, this is from their internal documents. They're investing. A lot of these companies are investing in what's going to happen after fossil fuels. We could finance a completely different level of economic base. The Northwest should be the leader in going in and cleaning these places up instead of just capping them off with something and ignoring them. Places like Coos Bay or little places on the coast or tribal lands inland, places like Longview or Kelso that are the weak links that these companies are trying to go in and squeeze in these toxic facilities because they're desperate for jobs, desperate for money, and they don't have the money to fight these big companies. So, you know, if we went in there instead and were training these people to clean these sites up and to bring materials in to be cleaned in these big areas that are sitting empty, we could be completely different infrastructure. This is a completely different economy based on doing the right thing for our lands. We could be going into forest areas and cleaning these up and helping reduce the fire danger. Divest and reinvest.
We're going to be having that conversation across universities, across campuses in the Pacific Northwest, to the best of our knowledge. This has never happened before, right? So it's a chance to make a really exponential leap in terms of these individual siloed organizing campaigns that are going on. So Robin, we're going to see you soon on November 13th between 4 and 7 p.m. For more information about the event and how to register, go to www.picoc.info. This has been Desiree Helgers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
This has been Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and thanks for tuning in this morning. Remember, you can find us on the web at KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. It's a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday at 9 a.m., and I want to thank all of our guests and contributors this morning. We had Bill Resnick and John Cavana. We had Desiree Helligers, Ray Austin, Diane Meisenhelter, and Jan Hawken, Mike Snedeker. Desiree returned to talk with Sarah Chivers and Old Mole, and Samantha Edgerton, and Robin White, Lakota Cheyenne activist who's working very hard for the community and for the Old Mole. We appreciate you visiting us this Monday morning post-election, and I feel a little bit better about the world, and I hope you do too. Let's keep the struggle.